Welcome to the Om Show. Today, I'm talking to my good friend, Iran Shear. He's the founder and CEO of Nexar and a very dear friend, also a very, very smart man. And just to be upfront about it, he's also, True Ventures has invested in his company. So that's a small disclosure. But that's not the reason he's here. He's here because he's got some great insights into computer vision and its impact on society. And he and I often talk about this topic whenever we meet. So it's really great to have you on my show, Iran. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
I heard there was a big computer vision conference last week in Tel Aviv, and you were one of the keynote speakers. How did that go?
Yes, it was amazing. Over 1,000 computer vision experts from all over the world, but a lot of them obviously from Israel, in one room. And what's also interesting is that for the first time, we actually did something quite cool. We picked the winning graduate students. You know, it's actually an academic conference. So you have graduate students kind of submitting papers, etc. And we gave a reward for the top two winning graduate students to do an internship, including in Berkeley, at the AI lab in Berkeley with Professor Trevor Darrell that works with us as well as Nexar. So it's been a blast.
You know, it's kind of exciting and interesting to see that 2 years ago, nobody actually was talking about computer vision. I think it was like roughly around 6 years ago when I got personally interested in computer vision and spent a lot of time researching what was happening. But I didn't really see this kind of traction till like two years ago, like maybe a little bit later than that. So what has happened in past 12 to 18 months that suddenly everybody is sitting up and noticing computer vision?
So in some way, I think what happened is also related to why we started Nexar, one of the reasons we started Nexar. A key thing that happened in about 3-4 years ago, but really materialized in the last 2 years, is the ability to push computer vision to commodity edge devices like smartphones, right? Up until a few years ago, we didn't have GPUs in smartphones, and when we talked about computer vision, we talked about companies like Google and Facebook and massive data centers and all this kind of stuff, and that was a huge limiting factor. What happened, the revolution, the secular shift that happened in the last few years, is that today, you know, the phone that you have in your pocket is an amazing platform for computer vision, deep learning, AI, all of that bag of tricks that we now have in our possession. And that created an avalanche. It created an avalanche of tools for developers that brought lots of people that, you know, it broke out of the cult. The know-how became something that is obvious or nearly obvious. And that opened up a whole set of use cases. People ask themselves, okay, what can we do with this? And, you know, anywhere from, is this a hot dog, all the way to medical applications came about.
Now, how did you and Nexar come to computer vision? What's your story, you know, before we dig deeper into the current trend?
Okay, so just a word for people that don't know what Nexar is. We're basically building or crowdsourcing a vision network for the road. We have our nodes, our cameras, our users on the road driving in cars, and we collect and we analyze and we run a computer vision on the edge. Now, how did we come about it? When Bruno, my co-founder, and I looked at the space in 2014, when I was like an EIR at the VC in Tel Aviv, and which means that I had all the time in the world to research, One key insight that we had all the way back in 2014 is that intelligence is going to be pushed to the edge. Like I said, up until that point, it was mainly in the data center and the cloud, as we call it. And we saw this trend emerging, and we knew that this trend is going to be massive because you have Apple and Intel and all these kind of companies pushing it to NVIDIA, Qualcomm, to enable computer vision, enable intelligence in the edge. That means real-time analysis, real-time activation. That means that we can do intelligent use cases in real time. And for me, and for most people that don't have to deal with rockets in their day-to-day life, driving is the most real-time thing. And on the other side, when we looked into driving, we saw this great cognitive dissonance, great sort of almost conundrum, because on the one hand, you know, there's been a massive increase in interest in autonomous vehicles. We were all kind of going into an autonomous vehicle in a few moments, right? In a year or two, we're going to be driving, or not driving, riding an autonomous vehicle. So that was one trend that you could see clearly on Google Trends. And the other trend was collisions. They were going up every year. Year over year, the number of fatalities, the number of collisions was growing. And that's true for the US, true for Israel, true pretty much all over the world. And that was kind of a very strange thing to consider, because on the one hand, you have all of these guys putting all this technology into the car. And on the other hand, it doesn't help. Actually, you see that the number of fatalities and collisions grows up. Last year, in 2017, we had in the US over 40,000 fatalities on the road. And that was the first year since 2007 that we got to that number. Basically, we got to down to 30,000 in around 2011. And since then, we're going up. So we were like asking ourselves, what's going on here? And obviously, the obvious answer is smartphones happened. Smartphones and distraction that comes with them are sort of a major cause of collisions. And we thought that if we'll turn that into part of the solution, not part of the problem only, we'll be able to make an impact in a short time scale and actually change that trend. And that's what we're trying to do. That was the basic insight that we had back then.
You know, you made a lot of comments on that. So Nexar is essentially an application which sits on my smartphone and looks out into the, and it's plugged onto the dashboard and looks out into the, onto the road and monitors what's happening on the road. And so when you are trying to, you know, take a step back and just say, what does that do in like from a larger perspective? Like, I understand that you collect the data, but how does that app action help with collision prevention?
Okay, so in car safety, there's this term that's called ADAS that I don't like, but that's the term. Basically, driver assistance systems. These are the features that you know if you have like a high-end car like a Tesla or Lexus, etc. Things like forward collision warning, warning you about you're about to hit the car ahead of you, or lane departure warning. These are the basic features that people know. We provide these features for free out of an app that you run on your phone. It might be connected to a dash cam camera installed in your car, or it might run just from the camera of the phone. And that those features are coming, you know, basically whatever car, in whatever car, regardless of whatever car you're using or driving. It can be a 67 Pontiac, we don't care. But we're doing something additional, which is something that the cars themselves cannot do. We network all of those nodes. Okay, so if I see a car ahead of me doing a hard brake and I get a warning that I need to break two, otherwise I'm going to hit it, I'm not the only one that gets that warning. The cars behind me also get that warning. And if I'm in an intersection and there's a car coming behind the corner, if it's part of the Nexar network or it's being seen by someone on the Nexar network, I will get a warning. So what we're doing is a playbook that is very similar to what Waze, for example, did to GPS a decade ago, right? Rather than just focusing on a TomTom device that is disconnected from the world, like your car, I'm building a network, a crowdsourced network that can react in a much better way.
So it's more of a, like, it becomes more useful as a network, not as a standalone application. It's essentially intelligent traffic monitoring in real time. So if that is the reality of Nexar, you must have a lot of requirements in terms of latency, in terms of making this very real time. I mean, given the nature of networks we have today, how do you achieve that?
So we had to actually engineer. We had to work really hard in order to make it happen. You need to squeeze all of the insights into the shortest or smallest message. You need to make sure that it's being delivered in the most efficient way. We today, in a place like San Francisco, can get to a latency of as low as 65 milliseconds, which for most intents and purposes is great, because our reaction time as humans is around half a second to a second. So 65 milliseconds is less than one-tenth of a second. That's nothing when it comes to human reaction. So we're really happy about that. It wasn't trivial, and we're going to continue working on it. But there is another insight that we use. And that insight is kind of obvious, but seldom said, which is cars don't fall off the sky. You know? What I mean by that is, if we know a vehicle's trajectory a second ago, we know pretty well where it's going to be now. Okay, so we might get a correction with every new detection of that vehicle and every new estimation of its velocity, etc. But that error will be hedged, will be confined. And so if we model the world, if we get to a state where every vehicle on the road is being basically has a counterpart, basically has an agent in our model that we monitor continuously, we can get to a very high accuracy.
Okay, does this accuracy increase, let's say, if you have more and more data, like if you're collecting more and more traffic signals and, you know, traffic patterns, does that make your system better?
For sure. Because you can predict better. And because you also can triangulate. You know, one of the cool things when you have a network is, let's say I'm detecting a white car, a white BMW on the right lane 20 meters ahead of me. And there's another Nexar vehicle detecting the same vehicle, you know, 30 meters ahead of itself. Okay, we can triangulate all of these detections in real time and figure out exactly where that car is. And that's something that you cannot do if you have a single car that you care about.
Now, you were mentioning that, you know, you guys figured out early that intelligent edge devices would be the wave of the future. And you know, Apple obviously has been pushing that vision for a while now. But what's the role of the cloud in this whole evolution? Because, you know, folks like Amazon and Google would like you to believe that everything should happen on their infrastructure. So how do you reconcile edge with the cloud computing movement?
So I believe that in general, entrepreneurship is about being a visionary and pragmatist at the same time. And so the way we apply that in this case is we are very focused on doing everything that we need in the edge for the real-time use cases, right? Like I cannot count on the cloud for doing computer vision in real time because I don't have that budget of time until to send a frame, to analyze it in the cloud, to get back a result. That's a non-starter. But what the cloud is really good at is in crowdsourcing, collecting a lot of data together, learning from it, improving models, and applying it. We have a system called Frame on Demand. Frame on Demand basically allows us to cherry pick specific frames or specific video segments that are of interest, pushing them to the cloud, learning from them, and then pushing back new models into our edge devices. A great example of that, just to illustrate, it was last year winter in New York. You know, we have a large presence in New York, and when the winter came, with it came lots of snow. And it turned out that our deep learning models weren't trained on lots of snowy roads and the way vehicles are seen in snow. So what happened is the confidence went down. As a result of that, frame on demand was triggered. We got lots of frames of snowy roads into the cloud, trained new models, pushed them back to the edge. That's a learning life cycle where the cloud plays a pivotal role.
When you look at your own model, how do you think this future will look like in general, right? Like when I think, hear about edge computing and cloud computing, it reminds me of the days when you went from mainframe and you had terminals, yeah, and then you went from mainframe and terminals to client server, and then you went to more like client server to PC into the server model, a PC to the network model. And like, how does this compare to the old paradigms? I mean, are we trying to kind of rebottle the wine in a new bottle, or like what's the story in your mind?
So for this, I can quote my director of deep learning, and his notion, which I like the way sort of framing is anything that a human can perceive, can understand in less than a second, we will be able to push to the edge. Okay, so if you think of all of the computer vision tasks, not only sensing tasks that humans do that take less than a second of their mental capacity, we will eventually be able to push them to the edge. And what the cloud will still be great at is doing the learning, doing the training for those intelligent edge nodes. There is another point on that might be worth mentioning, which is the difference between how network evolve versus how CPUs and GPUs evolve. You know, everyone knows Moore's law, obviously, but there is a similar law for network capacity and bandwidth and all of that stuff. But the thing is, networks evolve slower. The exponent is lower. And that means that over time, there will still be a gap. There will be a gap maintained between how fast compute will be available at the edge versus how much bandwidth will be available at the edge. So I think that for the next few years, it will still make a lot of sense to push as much intelligence to the edge rather than trying to bring in all of the data back to the cloud. In fact, if you talk to companies that build autonomous vehicles, their number one problem today is what to do with all of the data that the cars collect.
You know, you must know that we are investors in Venium, which actually solves that very problem for a lot of the big companies. And this is what I've been trying to understand, both from them, maybe, and I'm asking you, is that what is the implication of like a very intelligent edge and you know, in for other applications, not just computer vision, but other applications? Like what improves because of an intelligent edge in your mind?
Oh, so much. Understanding, I think the most important thing is understanding context. The context in which we exist has so many factors that we don't even think of, right? Right now, I'm sitting, I'm in an office. This office is a typical place that I'm going to every day. I'm talking, you know, there's all these things around context that are really important. And we can do a much, much better job in understanding context in a more humane fashion, yeah, in a more intelligent fashion. And to each his own, to each vertical, the slice of context that is more focused on. But for me, the number one application of that beyond computer vision is just to be very, very detail-oriented, very insightful as to the immediate context of humans.
So you mean like whether it's like context of where we are or like, you know, basically all the sensors and doing better sensor analysis on the device? Is that what you're saying?
So where we are is easy, right? You said GPS, et cetera. Even GPS is problematic still, but let's say we solve that. But I'm talking about context in a very sort of almost intimate fashion. We know, for example, that you're driving, and while you're driving, you're picking up your smartphone and you're tapping on it, and then you're putting it back, okay? And then now you stop driving, you're getting out of the car, you're starting to run or starting to walk, or you got home, you open the door, you said hello to your kid. That means that your kid is at home. I can go on and on and on with as deep, complex scenarios as possible. You know, one of the every entrepreneur has a set of ideas that he would love to see someone do, and one of these ideas that I'm trying to pitch people to do is a simple device that you plug into your one of your electric power outlets at home, and it monitors the health of your family. You know, how often you greet your wife with hello, and how often you shout at her. How often, you know, how much time your kids watch TV, etc., etc. You know, you can dream as to what kind of great stuff or creepy stuff, depending on where you stand, you could do with such a thing. And all you need is a microphone, a CPU, and some power. So these are the kind of things that we can imagine today with pushing intelligence to the edge, understanding context, understanding sensing the environment and our fellow humans in a more humane way.
Right. Now, what is your take on the impact of computer vision on society, like where we are? And, you know, it's just beginning to show up in edge devices. You know, you clearly are using it in your application. There is some other applications which have come up. What's your take on the social impact, the social cultural impact of computer vision?
Well, I would say that it's going to revolutionize pretty much every aspect of the human condition, as they say, pretty much every aspect of it. And I it's really hard for me to come up with a single example where computer vision won't have an impact. And today, we're starting to be in a place where the you know, it's you remember the time where people said, I'm doing an Uber 4? You know, and all the, like, it was annoying that people say, I'm doing an Uber for pets, Uber for whatever. So today we're a bit in that state where people just come up with all kinds of crazy, sometimes stupid ideas, sometimes great ideas. Well, I'm just going to take, you know, the latest and greatest from the TensorFlow zoo, deep learning model, apply it to this problem, and I'm going to build a business out of it. The places where I think it will make the most impact, first of all, in health, and even more than that, in health economics, which is a huge problem in the US in particular, not only. I think it can change the whole economics of diagnosis and even expert analysis in a fundamental way, democratize it really fully. Yeah. I can think of many other such examples.
You know, there is I was reading this study from maybe it was a paper in the Science Medicine Journal, which was essentially that they had some folks from Michigan State University had come up with an app which can use the phone and, you know, the camera on the phone to monitor your blood pressure. And it's a pretty interesting like idea. And, you know, there's other people who are doing other interesting things on analyzing, using the camera to analyze, you know, your health. And I think that just is a very small example of what can be done. So yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. The other place where I think would be fundamentally changed in a way that will impact society is life in the city. The experience of living in a city, which over 50% of humans today do, and, you know, this number keeps growing, is going to change in so many ways with the introduction of AI, deep learning, and cheap cameras in every corner. Not always for the better, but definitely going to change. And societies will need to grapple with how they're going to react to this change.
Right. Like, so what is, like, what should we be thinking about in terms of this change? I know there is a lot of creepy stuff which can happen. You know, I think privacy and, like, you know, how security is today changes because of computer vision. I mean, you know, you clearly have a lot of opinions about that. I would love to know how you're thinking this will have impact on privacy.
Yeah, so first of all, people need to understand that this is happening now. Like, if you look at China, they've deployed already 160 million cameras, many of them with face recognition and other computer vision features. And they're planning to deploy 400 million cameras. Okay, so consider what it means for a surveillance state or like or country like China. This is one example on the one extreme. Another example on the other extreme is Amber Alerts. You know, Amber Alerts, when there's a kidnapping in the US, all the phones are kind of vibrating with this information about the vehicle, etc. Consider you have a network of cameras and vehicles with cameras being deployed. It will take you 30 seconds to find that kidnapper, right? Find the license plate, find the car, find the... So that will get, you know, it will literally get rid of certain types of crimes. At the end day, it will make the public space much safer. The question is, are we willing to pay the prices that we need to pay in order to get that. And this is not a technological question, because on the technology side, we can do all of it, right? I can track a vehicle and know that that vehicle is owned by someone and is now not going to work, is going to his mistress. It can be done today without a problem. I can track a vehicle and know how good he is as a driver and what should be his premium. All kinds of use cases. The question, and it's a societal question, and it will be different in different places in the world, where do you want to stand in this line of utility versus, you know, rights for privacy, or rights for self-expression, or rights for control over your life? This is something that we will need to address with, or, you know, starting today, pretty much.
So before we delve into that, like let's talk about the China. If they have 400 million cameras with computer vision embedded into them, they're essentially building a much larger corpus of computer vision intelligence, maybe for their own people. Does that give an advantage to the Chinese startups in that sense? Does it, all those learnings can, I don't know, you know, how that's going to work out, but does the availability and like lack of privacy laws, does that give some sort of an advantage to the Chinese startup system?
For sure. It gives them a huge advantage, because today the difference between a successful computer vision or deep learning model and the so-so one ends up being data. Okay, if you have access to data and a lot of it, you will be better, because everything else is commodity. The algorithms are commodity. The models, all of that stuff, is pretty much commodity. To get to the 99 percentile, to the 99.9 percentile, you need a lot of data. And today, if you go to these conferences of computer vision, what you see is that many of them talk about all kinds of nice hacks about how to get a bit more data, all kinds of ways to use simulation in order to bridge the gap in data. And if you have a data source that is much, much bigger than anyone else, you will have the upper hand on quality. And that's, you know, that's for sure.
And so when you think about, you know, the Chinese ecosystem and its data advantages, how do you reconcile their advantages with the democracy and the openness of society here, which we need to deal with this? Like, we need to deal with the idea of what privacy is. We need to deal with what are citizen rights in this world, which is essentially there is a camera everywhere all the time. So what are your human rights? How do you reconcile those? I mean, it's definitely an interesting question to think about.
It is. Are we losing advantage by not going the way China goes? I would say that I am still very optimistic, because that's one dimension through which to measure things. I think that a more important dimension is your willingness to fail and your willingness to try things out. I think, and that's a cultural trait that is much harder to kind of adopt. You know, I remember when hosted the governor of Hong Kong and a delegation, and they asked me, how can we do, you know, build an ecosystem like Tel Aviv, like Silicon Valley in Hong Kong? And I told them, well, the first thing you need to do is you need to allow a 20-something kid to fail. And they were like, wait, but he needs to find a job and he needs to get married and he needs to do all this kind of stuff. So I told him, well, that's your problem. And that's it. So I still think we have some advantages. There's also a question of, okay, the Chinese government put all those 400 million cameras. That mean that it's going to distribute the IP to anyone or everyone. It definitely means that companies like Alibaba and Baidu and Tencent that are very close to the Chinese government will have a leg up compared to the Google and Facebook and Amazon in some aspects. But when it comes to startups, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, so I'm a very strong believer that there's always a way. Like today, for example, Nexar, we collect more driving hours a month than, you know, all of the car companies combined. And you could say, you know, 3 years ago, looking at all of these large companies and Google getting into autonomous vehicles, we could say this, you know, what chance do we have? But if you find the right way, you always have a chance. So I'm not too pessimistic on that.
You know, so there is, you know, I wouldn't be in the business of what I do if I didn't believe that there is always a better way in the future. But we're also dealing with a big social change right now. I think our idea of what civic space is, our idea of what daily life is changing because of the technology is becoming embedded into everything we do. And it's not just, you know, some random, you know, like just like you just said, you know, smartphones and, you know, collisions are going up because there are smartphones in our life. The benefits of a smartphone outweigh all the bad things, but there are the side effects of all this technology, which is becoming part of our civic existence. And I think when I think about this and I just say, okay, how do we make better rules around this? How do we regulate and legislate, you know, what's going to happen? I don't think, you know, what we are seeing right now is just this hyper reaction to let's regulate all tech companies. And like, you know, everybody is hyperventilating and people saying tech is the enemy. I just think it's not that extreme on either side. I think we actually have a problem. And we also have a problem that we need to innovate all the time. Otherwise, we will get left behind, you know, frankly, behind China if we don't innovate. And so it just is a huge quandary, to be honest.
So I think I would actually start with your last word, which is honesty. You know, we need to be honest about what we're talking about. And the first step in my mind in honesty is to say, it is obvious, it's deterministic, there's no question about it, that the public space will be continuously captured by cameras and other sensors at some point in the future. I don't think there's a reasonable set of claims that can convince an honest person that that's not going to be the future at some point. Right? There's just too much technological pressure, economic pressure, too much convenience that is all ultimately, you know, the number one force that pushes society in making every square inch of the public space captured by cameras. And so we should start with there at that point, and then we ask, okay, now what? How do we deal with that situation? And what kind of behaviors we as a society are willing to accept or not accept? What kind of use cases we're willing to tolerate, and what things we think cross the line. And once we have that discussion in a reasonable way, then I would say, okay, we're getting somewhere. If we'll just say, no, I'm not willing to give up my civil liberties, I'm not willing to do that, when you see this avalanche that we're faced, it's just not useful.
Right. And I think, you know, what I'm also, you know, trying to point to is that, you know, we have these cameras in place, like people, for instance, police in the U.S. wear body cameras, and there is, and they capture images in which, you know, they are committing essentially, you know, atrocities, and yeah. They still get away with it because we don't believe what we see on the image. And I'm just like thinking, okay, so there is a lot of, you know, intellectual resistance to this change, which is coming from the presence of cameras everywhere. And I don't mean cameras as in like cameras, but also these visual sensors, which are becoming embedded in our lives now.
Yeah, it's cameras plus intelligence, because cameras on its own is one thing, but cameras plus intelligence is reaction, is being able to cherry pick the interesting things. And that's really important. There is another point that we should be aware of. It is becoming available, just like computer vision has become available in recent years. It's starting to become available, the ability to spoof any kind of video, including audio, that you could imagine, right? Like this AI technology, deep learning, all of stuff is getting to a place where I could create a believable video of you dancing naked on the beach, and you know your family will believe it. And that's an issue that we also need to address. I think people don't address it enough. We need to create basically a chain of custody for video and audio information, probably something leveraging blockchain or some other kind of technology, but that's also part of it, because it's going to be possible and going to be easy very soon.
Right. So what do you think about this notion that if we can do that, then, you know, our favorite actor doesn't have to die ever again, or
yeah.
Our favorite newscaster can read news to us all the time, and that becomes like almost like a personalized, you know, Anderson Cooper reading news just for me instead of CNN.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
That's gonna be tough. That's gonna bring a lot of questions. That in some ways, almost the last place where I feel, you know, I feel I'm an old timer, right? That I feel some kind of repulsion from the notion of, you know, one of my loved ones have died and I'm bringing him back to life to interact. Think of that with a smart chatbot, and it getting into a very creepy place that I don't know how to react to it. Honestly, I feel that it's going to be bad if we'll do that. On the other hand, I don't really know how it's not going to be done. I don't think that there's a way to stop this kind of use cases.
I know. I think it'd be pretty cool to have your favorite TV people reading you news. I mean, rather than going to their, you know, stupid network, like it'd be pretty cool. Just the news, you know, you have your own, you know, one person CNN, like, and you just deal with it.
That would be cool, but I'm more worried about, you know, there was a sort of a podcast called Afterlife a year ago, mm-hmm. where people got addicted to shadows of their old, family members, and these are kind of the more creepy use cases that, and in some way, I think this will be more addictive than a prank in, you know, or a nice trick for your birthday.
Yeah, I personally like, you know, memories are way better in your head than on a smartphone app. That's how I feel. But again,
but then you go
said,
to a concert and you see everyone watching the concert through their smartphone because they have to record it through it, and it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I know, but like that's the generation we have coming up now, because they just use the phone to do everything. And so it's an interesting, you know, shift in social norms. And, you know, what, like you just said the right word, very old fashioned of us to think about past in like the past and, you know, memories, like not as, you know, something we can recall on our screen. Anyway, let's talk about AR. What do you think about AR now from your vantage point? You think you're excited about it? Like, are there any, you know, use cases you see because of computer vision that you know, that would become pervasive?
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's still a decade away, honestly. Mainly because the form factor is still not there. You know, I had the great pleasure this morning to go and try out a new glasses that actually look like glasses, right? That you can believe that you can go to a glass store, an optometrist, and choose those glasses because they look cool. And on the way, they also have some information projection capabilities. And it's starting to be there for really basic stuff, like giving you a snippet of text. But I cannot imagine people walking or spending a long time with the likes of AR devices that are currently coming to the market. I think it still, and there's another cycle there until it will become something that actually impacts the world. I mean, in the enterprise world, it's going to be, you know, it's going to provide impact earlier for surgeons, for example, technicians and people like that. I totally see the value and it's worth it to do that. But for consumers, in my mind, it will still take a while beyond some unforeseen breakthroughs that are coming down the pipe.
Right. So what are you excited about in both in your own field, which is computer vision, and in technology at large?
Well, first of all, I'm very excited about the notion of actually, you know, driving safer, leveraging computer vision. And note that I'm not saying autonomous driving. I'm saying driving safer, augmenting human decision making, not augmenting reality, augmenting human decision making, and making an uncrashable car is something that I do see as coming soon. Compared to making a level 5 autonomous vehicle, which will take a while. That's one thing. The other thing that I'm very excited about, have been for a long time, is crypto and blockchain applications. I think that it's an extremely important trend. It's funny. I wrote a bit more than 4 years ago, I wrote a blog post called Bitcoin Speculations. And I call this speculations because I put there stuff that I didn't want people to think I'm crazy. So I put on the word speculation as a warning. And now you see things moving so quickly, the things that I talked back there, where every company will have its own currency. You know, you start to see this emerging. The other thing I talked back then on is that for each one of us will have its own currency. We're still far away from that, but I think that's quite achievable. It's not something that is beyond, beyond some massive a mountain. And I think that there's so many interesting stuff that's going to happen, because it's the first time, if you look at it the most fundamental way, It's the first time we get a shot at A/B testing economies, at experimenting with economies. We never had that opportunity. You know, we used to live in a country that it has the economy that it had, and that was it. And now we get this really easy on-ramp to try out different incentive structures, different economies, and see what happens. So that's one thing. The other thing that gets me really excited is up until now, a company was the pretty much the only way to effectively organize human energy, right? Since people invented the LLC some 500 years ago, you know, that was the main way. And that's actually a very inefficient way of organizing human energy. It's a tree structure. It's not a network. It's very fragile. And with this new concept of crypto and tokens, you can now organize a lot of human energy in the form of a network. And that's a way more resilient thing. And I think it might change the whole way we think of, you know, economy.
Is it like economy, or are we talking about incentive structures? I think economy is a little bit, you know, broader. You know, it goes beyond just money. But are we talking about incentive structures which change because of crypto?
I think this distinction is just a part of this being an infant field. I think that, you know, the economy in its most basic definition, I subscribe to a professor from Stanford that writes around technology and economy. He says that, you know, economy at the end of the day is how society reorganizes itself around a new technology, right? You have a new technology being introduced, the whole societal structures change in reaction to that new technology, and you have, you know, that's what we call an economy. And it used to be that they were disjoint, right? I introduced electric motors in 1880, and it took 40 years, and all the factories have moved from what they had before. And lots of people lost their job, lots of people got new jobs. The economy reorganized itself. That's what we have seen across the 10,000 years of society since the agriculture invention. What's unique about crypto is that the invention is not anymore devoid from the economy. It's like now we can, the innovation, the technology is around defining the rules of the game, which is something interesting. It allows us to do small A/B tests. I can take a certain market or certain segment of the economy, put a new incentive structure, and see what happens, which is a superpower that we never had. And I think that's interesting.
Well, it all looks great for now. And, you know, I'm excited about what the future brings. And hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about this again very soon, especially when you're visiting me in San Francisco. So I want to take a moment and thank you for sharing your insights and, you know, having this conversation with me and my listeners today. So thank you, Aaron, and really wish you good luck with Nexar.
Oh, thank you, sir. Really happy to be part of this.
Great. Thanks.